I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We have had a bit of a hiatus from Saturday streams. I apologize for that. I'm just really busy with stuff. And sometimes I can't scrape up a guest or a topic or the enthusiasm to give you a good stream and first do no harm. Rather not do a stream if it's going to be bad. But fortunately, we are back and we have a very good guest tonight, and that is, or today, depending on what time zone you're in, that is Alexander Adams, who has just published a book called Blood, Soil, Paint. So, Alexander, welcome to the show.
Hi, Greg. Thank you very much for inviting me on.
Well, you have recently published this book with Imperium Press. These people are friends of ours. Blood, Soil, Paint. It's a subtitled An Essay on Romanticism, Nationalism, and Art. And I would like to talk about the book and the topics in that book. Folks, if you have questions for Alexander and me, please send them along. You can send them along in three ways. You can go to entropystream.live/countercurrents if you want to do the super chat route, which is very much appreciated. Your donations help us stay on the air. You can also send DLive tokens and questions, and you can send tips and questions through Odyssey. We are streaming on both platforms today. Try and get any questions for Alexander in the first hour, because after the first hour, I'm going to segue to a solo AMA, and it'll just be a free-for-all thing on many different topics, not art-related topics. So Alexander, tell me a little bit about yourself. You know, no, don't dox yourself, but a bit about your background and your bio and how you came to be both an author and an artist.
Well, I think people can find out more about me if they search. So I'm not doxing myself at all. Alexander Adams is my professional name. And I live in England. I was born in England. I studied in London. Goldsmiths College. I studied fine art and art history. So half of it was practical, half of it was theory or historical study. And that was in the 90s. And since then, I've been a practicing artist, a professional artist. I've exhibited all over the world in museums in North America, Europe, principally Britain, but also elsewhere. Got work in different collections. And so I functioned as a professional artist for quite a long time. Then I took up the writing, which had kind of lapsed after university. I did that in the early 2000s when I was living in Berlin. And since then, I've done more and more writing, increasingly focusing on culture, the visual arts, literature. So this is a good time for me to tell you about where you can see this writing. And that's at alexanderadamsart.substack.com. If you want to follow my art, it is alexanderadams.art. Yeah, so a lot of that stuff is really accessible, and also my books, the number of books that I've written, so some on more cultural issues and political issues, and some just sort of straight books on artists, and they're all available at all book-selling websites, so they're available internationally. So yeah, I was doing lots of art reviews and visiting museums, reviewing books, and this was fairly conventional stuff. And then I started noticing some cracks in the liberalist outlook that permeated the arts, especially in Britain, but also I think in North America as well. And so I got more interested in that and writing about that. And that led me to sort of reconsider some of the histories that I'd been taught. So I started looking at the reactionary tendency and right-wing tendencies in art, especially in avant-garde art rather than traditional art. And this is the point where I plug your book, a Countercurrents book, which is Reactionary Modernism, a collection of speeches by Jonathan Bowden, which I highly recommend to all your listeners. It's a fascinating read.
Thank you. I was going to ask you about that book.
Yes.
So I'm glad you jumped in there. There was a book years ago that was brought out by Cambridge with the title Reactionary Modernism that dealt with Ernst Jünger and others. And it was a kind of lousy book, but I loved the title. And so I decided I'm going to reuse that title for a good book. So we brought that out. So I'm glad you liked it.
Well, actually, my thanks to Countercurrents for preserving these videos. If people don't know, Jonathan Bowden was a right-wing British thinker on culture, literature, aesthetics. He was a novelist. He wrote creative work as well as giving lots of speeches, not so much articles, but speeches about politics and culture. And yeah, so he gave these whole series of lectures that were videoed, but they were unscripted. And so Countercurrents and various associates have trawled through the videos and selected some of the best and written down the transcripts. And the transcripts are what forms the basis of Reactionary Modernism, which I've recently been enjoying and I can recommend. And Bowden brings up some very interesting things, especially to do with the way that the right used avant-garde, that it was quite elitist. And that this is something that is not talked about very much because, of course, when we talk about avant-garde art in the 20th century, we're often looking at someone like Picasso. Picasso joined the Communist Party. So there is like a natural, and also, you know, like the early years of the Soviet Union, modernism was the official art. So I think a lot of people associate avant-gardism and vanguard art with the left, but it's actually it was used as much by the right as by the left.
Yeah, that was something that was very much a surprise to me when I first became aware of these issues back in the 1990s. And I was trying to figure out, how is it that Bala or some of these Italian futurists, these people who created these strange canvases and sculptures made out of metal that come screaming off the wall at you, how is this right wing? So I was fascinated with that. And Jonathan really struck a nerve with me in his discussion of that too. I thought that that was important. Another person that we published on some of the same ground is Kerry Bolton in his book, Artists of the Right. He talks about primarily literary figures there. I would love to have more work on Artists of the Right. We brought out another volume of Bolton's essays with the scintillating title, More Artists of the Right. And then I brought out a book on my friend Charlie Kraft called An Artist of the Right. I would love to have more stuff, though, at Countercurrents about, for instance, we published a few things about Dalí. Dalí was very much a man of the right and also one of the great artists of the 20th century. He just laughed when the communist-dominated surrealists tried to expel him from their little movement. He said, I, Dalí, am surrealism. You know, he cannot be expelled.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this is the point where I plug my own book on Salvador Dalí, which has been published by Prestel, which is a big German publisher, art publisher. And they asked me to write a whole series. Invited me to write about different artists. So I've written one on Degas, one on Magritte, the surrealist. And then the third one was on Dalí. And I was very interested to go a little deeper into his politics and to treat him a little more seriously in terms of his political outlook. Because I think this is something that people tend to skip over because they're naturally either left inclined or they've got a liberal outlook. And to be fair, it is quite easy to dismiss Dalí because he was an absolute sensationalist. He was an extremist. He was a reactionary. He did things to provoke. And he didn't always mean everything that he said. But I think his political outlook as an elitist, as a self-proclaimed genius, someone who did not believe in that art was the province of the common man, a natural aristocrat, as well as being an anarchist, that's an interesting aspect that I could only touch on very briefly in this book. But I recommend that if you want a slightly right of center perspective on Dalí, then my book is worth having a look at, as well as I'm sure the books that you've published.
So this Dalí book, is it currently in print?
Yes. Well, it's in print in Europe, at least now. It will be coming to America. It may not be showing up on your book selling websites at the moment, but it is coming this summer. It's already out here. There's a German version, so if you have German listeners, they can get a translation, a German version right now. So yes, it's available now, either if not now, then coming in the next couple of months.
Well, that's very exciting. I'm going to get James O'Meara, who is our resident Dalí fan, to write a review of this. I think that would be quite interesting.
Yes, that sounds exciting.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I'm seeing it on amazon.de, And I'm seeing it's going to be out in June in the United States on the regular Amazon.
Uh-huh.
So right so around the corner.
Yeah, so it came out in May this month in Europe in the English and German versions, and the English version is coming to America in June.
Yeah, perfect. So you talk in Blood, Soil, and Paint, and we don't have to talk entirely about this book because you've written others and they're all of interest, but you talk about several artists in here that I find interesting, and you talk about themes connected with Romanticism and nationalism, Nordic character, the Nordicists, and you talk about writers like Hamsun and Heidegger, and also Edvard Munch. And Munch is a fascinating figure, but how does Munch fit into your overall theory about Romanticism and modernism and the Nordic character? I don't really know anything about Munch's politics or his cultural politics, for instance. So how does he fit into this larger picture?
Well, I would say that Munch fits in pretty well because Romanticism is largely a movement of Northern Europe. It's quite telling that you don't find many Italians or Greeks or Spaniards involved in the Romantic movement, certainly at a high level, certainly in the visual arts. I mean, there's sort of claims and counterclaims about Goya, but let's set him aside. I think that Romanticism really suits the Nordic character because it's quite reflective, it's often prone to melancholy, it's brooding upon nature, especially harsh nature, and man as being subservient or at least inferior to nature, because this is something that you experience in the colder climes in northern latitudes, because you are literally struggling for survival. If you're not planning for the future, then you're dying over the winter. So it's something that's quite pressing. It's on your mind in a way that if you lived in Iran or Egypt or Italy, it really isn't, because your climate is so mild. And obviously that feeds into the idea about some character being derived from environment, which maybe we'll touch on in a bit. But Edvard Munch was born in the 1860s. He died in 1944, I think it was. He lived in Germany and in Berlin, and he came to influence the Expressionists very much in the 1890s and the 1900s, because he had a series of exhibitions that were considered quite scandalous, because he was taking on subjects like death, sickness, puberty, jealousy, envy, depression, and he was treating these in quite a frank manner without any recourse to sort of literary starting points. There was no literary pretext for these paintings. They were quite direct, and he was speaking about core issues, perennial issues. So I would think of him as a vitalist or a perennialist, because he's treating these essential human experiences in a way that's quite unvarnished and tough and memorable. I think that's what great art has to be. It has to be memorable, it has to be exciting, it has to imprint itself on your consciousness so that it has a lasting impact on you. Munch himself, his politics somewhat opaque. He's kind of, I mean, obviously he's associated with the avant-garde movement, so he's tended to be seen as championed by liberals and leftists and progressives, because he's seen as sort of breaking away from the academy, which was seen as sort of conservative, not unfairly. But he was also seen as, because he was treating things in such a raw way, and he was actually quite something of a loner and a groundbreaker, he was seen as a heroic individualist. And so naturally that aligns with the idea of the romantic artist being separated from society and rejecting society. And that's why he became a hero to the expressionists, the German expressionists who were working in the 1900s and 1910s. And they became big supporters of the Nazi party. So he's sort of seen as sort of one or two steps removed from extreme nationalism, as it were. He did reject the Germans when they occupied Norway during the Second World War, which is in contrast to Nuthamson, which we might talk about in a minute. Nuthamson was quite forgiving and supportive of the Nazi occupation. Munk rejected it, even though he did have supporters in the Nazi party. Joseph Goebbels was a supporter of Munk, and he fought to try and get artists like Munk and the Expressionists into the National Socialist canon, as it were, because they were seen as Northern and Nordic and raw. But essentially it was Hitler and the more conventional bourgeois elements of the Nazi party that won out, and they got a kind of a softer romanticism as the official style of the Nazi party.
That's very interesting. There's a strong vitalist element on the right, intellectual vitalism. And I think that can express itself in art like Munk or like the Expressionists. But also, when you look at the Italian Futurists, there's a lot about sound and speed, vitality, life, and so forth, bursting all representational bounds, basically, which I find really quite remarkable. I remember when I was living in New York City in 2014, it was quite a year for reactionary modernist art, because there was a giant exhibition on Italian Futurism at the Guggenheim. Yeah. Downtown at the Italian district, formerly sort of Italian-American area, at the Center for Italian Modernist Art, there was an exhibition on Fortunato DePero, who was one of the Expressionists who did things like advertising. And then at the Neue Gallery, there, just up the street from the Guggenheim, there was an exhibition on basically on degenerate art. But they also had some of the healthy stuff in there. And they also had a lot of poster art from the National Socialist period. I found the healthy art somewhat bland, to be perfectly honest, sort of a safe neoclassical. But they had a room on expressionism, and the rightist element of expressionism that I thought was very interesting, and how that was sort of nipped in the bud by the official government policy. But that was never done in Italy for some reason. The Italians, I think because maybe Mussolini didn't have any strong artistic opinions of his own, he sort of allowed a variety of different schools of art to flourish under his regime, including this radical modernism of the futurists.
Yeah, I think, yes, that's a very good observation. It's very striking when you look at Italy in the 1930s versus Germany in the 1930s, that what you see in Italy is quite a wide range of styles. You've got sort of like academic art, you've got neoclassical art, you've got sort of religious art.
Sort of Italian Art Deco was a thing.
Yes. Yeah. And then, of course, you've got the hypermodernism of the Futurists. And now the Futurists, their heyday was kind of in the late 1900s and the early 1910s. But there was still a considerable following for them, especially in poster art. Yeah, so what you find is lots of modernist posters take up a lot of the technical designs and a lot of the character of futurist art from preceding decades. And you're right, I guess it is because Mussolini was not, obviously Hitler had been a painter in the sort of in the 1910s or something, or 1900s. And he had attempted to get into art school, but he hadn't got in. It was quite a competitive art school. So I don't think automatically sort of sneering at Hitler for having failed an exam, I think it's failed twice. I don't think that necessarily tells you very much about his qualities as an artist. Although I've seen a fair bit of his art. I don't rate him very highly, but I think he was quite competent. But yeah, Mussolini, quite forgiving, and I think that the fascists themselves were temperamentally inclined to step back. So as long as it wasn't anti-Mussolini, anti-fascist, and anti-Italian, I think they pretty much anything went.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I did notice at this Neue Gallery exhibition is they had a hallway full of posters from the Third Reich era and before, done by the party. And I thought those were very strong aesthetically in terms of design. And I thought it was interesting that some of the best design work and artistic expression, if you will, was sort of crowded out of the galleries and into things like poster art. A friend of mine showed me a book of like telegram forms that you could buy to have your telegrams typed out on the other end and delivered. And they were sort of various standardized forms with, for, you know, birthdays, funerals, mm-hmm. things like that, or just something fancy if it's an important telegram. And the design of things as simple as telegram forms are often extremely bold and compelling. Just trivial things. There was a very high level of design aesthetics going on there, but it did seem to be crowded to the margins and not in the official art exhibitions, with some exceptions. A figure like Arno Breker, for instance, is a genuinely great artist, and I think his work will, you know, always be regarded very highly. But a lot of the other stuff was, it's just kind of bland.
Yeah, a lot of it, well, it's difficult to judge because a lot of it was kind of, it disappeared, as it were. I mean, actually, weirdly enough, the best collection was actually held in Washington, D.C. for a long time because it was confiscated during the occupation in 1945. It was physically removed because it was sort of to be treated as an anthropological curiosity, as it were. You know, how could these civilized Germans have sort of spawned this sort of backward, crazy, traditionalist art? Well, it was partly anthropological material, but it was also partly dangerous political propaganda. So there was this treatment of it as being not really art at all and being extremely dangerous at the same time. And so a lot of it was spirited off to Washington, D.C. Some of it has since come back, and it's now in, interestingly enough, in German historical museums, but not in fine art museums, that it's being treated slightly differently. It's not been allowed to sort of contaminate the mainstream museums in Germany. But you're right about lots of the modernist aesthetic and urge, which was quite strong in Weimar Germany in the 1920s, not least because of the Bauhaus, which taught modernist design, product design, furniture, architecture, as well as painting. A lot of those artists who studied at the Bauhaus were kind of driven out, and they elected to leave in 1933. But a lot of their influence, their modernist influence, you can see, you're quite right, it's in the posters, it's in book covers, it's in magazine design. You also find it in the more utilitarian areas of architecture. So, for example, the airport that they designed was designed in a sort of modernist style. It was using lots of concrete, reinforced concrete and so forth. Same for industrial buildings, the same for motorways, the Autobahn network and so forth. All of that was done in a modernist style. So the Germans were quite pragmatic, and they were keen to default to that when it was the most obvious solution in terms of design, in terms of architecture. They didn't mind it in their posters, but they didn't consider it suitable for their art galleries. And that's why you find like a lot more academic, traditional and Biedermeier style in the art of the time, which, you're right, it does seem a little bit tired or unexciting, even though there was a lot of competent artists who were working like that. I think a lot of the more innovative stuff, the modernist stuff, was principally in the applied art.
So let's talk a bit about your theses about the connection between Romanticism and the Enlightenment, and then Romanticism and nationalism. I think these are two very interesting topics.
Yeah, so I see nationalism, obviously a national character, national feeling, national sentiment, people seeing themselves as part of a nation or an ethnos. That's obviously something that goes a long way back, and I think it's quite a natural thing. I think it is, it's the natural response. I think also seeing yourself as part of a community, a local people or a local tribe, I think that's also a natural thing. It's something that's, of course, been anathematized since 1945, but I do think it's the natural state of viewing the world. Now, you know, sort of extreme intolerance and violence related to that, that may be something else. But I think that viewpoint, that outlook is perfectly normal and natural. I think it develops organically. But what you have happens in the French Revolution, I have to say that this is not an original thesis of mine. It's something that's sort of been drawn from a number of different sources, but I'm just sort of presenting it in a particularly clear way, in a distilled fashion in the book. So you have the French Revolution and you have the execution of the king. This shows that this sort of effectively breaks the covenant between the people and God, where the king, the monarch, is basically God's representative on earth, and he is working for the people. He is governing the people from following the rules of God, but also he is serving the people in the, and this is his way of serving God. Once you cut that strand, and also as you do in the French Revolution, you basically essentially abolish religion, or you downgrade it, you attempt to introduce a new religion, the religion of the worship of the supreme being, which was supposed to be a rationalist humanist religion. I think if you start out talking about a rationalist humanist religion, I think that you're naturally going to fail. And of course, that I don't think people took that aspect, that religious aspect, very seriously, because it was clearly an artificial construction. So what happens is, how do you bind your nation together if your leader, if your king, is gone? Well, one way is you start talking about nationalism. You talk about national character, and national character rooted in your geography, your climate, your food, your language, that this is all going to be tied up with a broader sense of nationalism, which will bind your people together when they are no longer bound by the fealty to a king who is divinely appointed. So this is the rise of nationalism, and romanticism is both an extension of and a slight reaction against nationalism. Romanticism is often seen as a twin of nationalism. It's related, it's interdependent on it. You also see the rise of romanticism exactly correlated to the first decades after the French Revolution in the 1780s. So what you have is the rise of the romantics, who are pushing back against Christianity. They're strongly interested in pagan origins, ancient origins, old tribes. They're interested in prehistory. They go around and they paint the dolmens, the stone circles. They start sort of investigating the pre-Christian oral traditions and the epics. And they want to find out more about the ancient gods, especially about the Nordic gods, which is sort of would contrast with the Semitic gods, which had dominated Europe for so long. And it's also a reaction against the Enlightenment. It's against humanism, against logic, in a way. It's saying that man is more complicated, and it is absolutely necessary to have these instinctive urges, which are primitive and existed in our forebears, in our pre-Christian forebears. They're also anti-industrial revolution. It's a reaction against the Industrial Revolution. They're against the mechanization. They're against urbanization. So you see a tendency for them to go out into nature and commune with nature, expressly to dilute or to combat the effects of the Industrial Revolution.
I think that's all very well said. And I think there is an organic connection, definitely, between the Enlightenment, the emergence of nationalism, especially when you start having to figure out who is the sovereign after the king. What is the natural locus of sovereignty? It would be a people who are bound together by a common history, by extended family character, by a common language, by a common sense of destiny, and so forth. And so there is an inherent pluralism, inherent cultural pluralism that emerges with nationalism, with the Enlightenment, with this sort of disenchantment with absolute monarchy, with empires that are sort of remnants of absolute monarchies. These exist because of dynasties and wars. They don't exist because of anything natural, I guess, is the sense. Now, the question then I have is how is modernism related to romanticism? And how is modernism particularized by nationality? Or is it a sort of transnationalist movement? There's certainly a strand on the left that wants to claim that modernism is overcoming the past. That would include national identity and things like that. And there were certainly a lot of leftist modernists. But what were the rightist and nationalist modernists thinking? How were they relating this artistic revolution in painting or in literature to their national identity and national traditions? How did that all fit together?
Well, thank you for that extremely long and complex question, which is raising a lot of issues. I'll try and keep it brief. So modernism as an extension of romanticism, yes. So the romantics are kind of anti-recent tradition. They're sort of, a lot of them are thinking in perennial terms. They want to go back to prehistory. They want to go back to the very ancient myths, but they don't want to be tied to academies. They don't want to be tied to Raphael and the Renaissance. They reject that. They want to go back earlier. But essentially, they're anti-traditionalists. They're generally anti-monarchists. They're anti-religious almost always. So they might be pagans, or make references to sort of pre-Christian religions and cults and so forth in a rather sort of vague, non-specific way. So they're anti-Christian and they're anti-Judaism. And in a way, modernism is essentially an extension of that, because modernism is also anti-religion, anti-monarchy, anti... Now, the question is, another part of your question was, how international is modernism? Well, there's an architectural style called international modern. And that is the sort of, rectilinear buildings, lots of steel, lots of glass, use of reinforced concrete, the lack of ornamentation, the lack of specific local materials in architecture and so forth. And that is the apex of modernist architecture, and that is truly international, and you will find that anywhere. And if you take a photograph of that and you crop it correctly, there is no way you would be able to look at that and determine the nationality of the architect or the location of the building. So in that sense, that kind of modernism is absolutely international, and it is specifically evangelically globalist. It sets out to demolish those boundaries, those ties to the past, which, are seen as sort of inhibiting or parochial in some sense. So yes, there's this strong international modernist aspect. Yet when you go to an art bookshop, you'll find all sorts of books on national art, German art, German modernism. So what's that? That's expressionism, isn't it? And then it's the Weimar Republic, and it's Otto Dix with his satires and George Grosz. And then it's going to be sort of photo montages of John Hartfield, who was German, but who adopted an English name just to hack off, just to irritate Germans. He adopted it during the First World War, when English names were not very popular, but he chose to take an English name just deliberately to spite people. So anyway, so that's German modernism. And what's French modernism? Well, that's surrealism, Oh, and what about English modernism? English modernism is neo-romanticism. It's John Piper, it's Graham Sutherland. And this eventually morphs into Francis Bacon to a degree. So there are really strong national characters inside modernism. But modernism as a whole, there are strong international aspects as well. The right, what did the right see in modernism? Well, I think they saw a chance to destroy or undermine lots of liberalist precepts. So you had the Men of 1914, who are a fascinating group. So this is Ezra Pound, T.E. Hume, T.S. Eliot, James Joyce, Yeats, the poet, the Irish poet, and they were seen as groundbreakers. And a lot of their and also Wyndham Lewis, of course, the artist and writer, Wyndham Lewis. And they were seen as very avant-garde. Their politics are quite nationalist, quite reactionary in some cases. Obviously, people will know about Ezra Pound getting into trouble with the Americans after having broadcast in favor of Mussolini and the fascists during the Second World War. But they saw modernism as a way of, as a battering ram against tradition, also against the internationalist, the sort of brotherhood of man aspect of Christianity. So obviously someone like Eliot kind of rose back on that because he becomes a sort of a high Christian, high Catholic afterwards, or high church Anglican. But there were different things that the rightist avant-garde saw in modernism. So also if you look at someone like the futurists, which you've mentioned, you know, very well, they were in favor of mechanization. They were in favor of modernization. They were in favor of urbanization. So this is absolute opposite of the romantics. And they see this as a way to destroy the stultifying grip of tradition and Catholicism on the Italians, because it's specifically an Italian movement. And this plays very well with their sort of very militaristic outlook. And so you find that these things mesh quite well. So the avant-garde actually finds quite a lot in modernism in specific areas. Also the left does as well.
Mm-hmm. It strikes me that both the left and the right appropriate modernism in a revolutionary way, because there was a movement, a conservative revolution in Germany, for instance, or futurism was a revolutionary movement. Both of these movements were really forged around the time of the First World War. Well, futurism antedates that, but it really got a charge by the First World War because there was a sense that, okay, wherever we are now, there's something terribly wrong. The system that brought about that war and couldn't prevent it and couldn't end it in a timely fashion was terribly degenerate, and we needed to come up with an alternative. There was also this new sense of community that was forged in the trenches. Some of that was, it was a revolutionary energy, and it wasn't a revolutionary energy that could primarily be channeled in the direction of the left. The Marxists were really quite taken aback by the First World War because they thought, well, the proletariat will rise up.
Yes.
Well, it turns out that the proletariat identified very strongly with the particular nation states and empires to which it belonged and eagerly embraced the war to one extent or another. So there was a new nation-based community of people who had risked their lives in combat, who had a sense that the current system was utterly corrupt and needed to be revolutionarily overthrown. But then the question is, replaced with what? The left had some rosy vision of a workers' paradise. People on the right, they didn't necessarily want to go backwards, but they wanted to bring things that were from the past back to the present. They wanted to break through the crust of recent society in a revolutionary way and access something healthy and vital and bring it forward. And so they were both conservative in the sense that they looked to some elements of the past for vitality, for health, for salvation as an alternative to the present. But they were revolutionary precisely because they believed that they had to dedicate themselves wholeheartedly to overthrowing the present. And you can see the sort of modernist rage in these thinkers of the right against the current system, the present, right? And looking backwards towards things that were healthier. So Ezra Pound might have poured all kinds of scorn on recent poetry, but what is he looking back to? He's looking back to, well, Homer. He's looking back to the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. He's looking to the Chinese. He's looking to older, more vital traditions that he wants to bring back. And I think that that is sort of a way that these people square the circle. They embrace these deconstructive and radical modernist techniques in the service of trying to access something that's older and vital and primal and bringing it back into the present.
Yeah, absolutely. You get different responses. So I'll just mention three very briefly. So you had the Dadaist movement, which sprang up during the war, which was a group of artists mainly working in neutral Switzerland, which is where a lot of artists who could get out of being conscripted, that's where they ended up. So it's sort of run basically from New York and Zurich. And so the Dadaists were sort of, they were extreme pacifists, they were absurdists, they were anti-art, they were anarchists, at the same time, they were both idealists and they were nihilists. You know, they absolutely didn't believe in anything, and they definitely didn't believe in what was causing the war. So they were sort of very skeptical of militarism, of industrialism, of monarchy. They were often tied to sort of far left, but, you know, you could also say that a lot of this sort of stuff fueled far right in Germany, the extreme disillusion with the military industrial complex, as it were, and the idea of sort of international finance having played a key part in the First World War. And this sort of drives a lot of sentiment in Germany in the 1920s, which leads to 1933. Then you've got a veteran of the war, so someone like Max Ernst, who fights in the German army against the French, survives the war, decides he's going to become a pacifist, who's going to become like an internationalist. He moves to Paris, he speaks French, he's part of the Dadaist movement, and then he joins the Surrealists. And the Surrealists are based in Paris, and they're basically essentially an offshoot of the Communist Party, but they're also an offshoot of Dadaism. So they're also they're anarchists and radical individualists. So obviously that doesn't really align with communism at all. So there was quite a lot of friction there. But Max Ernst becomes a leading light in this sort of pacifist, crazy, utopian, free-thinking, extremist, libertine group that is also dedicated to advancing the socialist revolution. And then in Italy, you have something like the Novecento movement, which is essentially a lot of futurists and metaphysical artists from the First World War, as you say, reaching back into tradition, reaching back to core elements that have been discarded, and they start painting landscapes, they start looking at regional Italian architecture, they start thinking about essential elements, returning to tradition, returning to essential forms, returning to subjects that you would recognize, but also painting them in a slightly modernist way. So they're not going full academic, they're not going full Renaissance, they're going back to the themes and subjects of the past, but they're treating them in a slightly modernist way.
So I want to, we're coming up on the end of our time, we've got about 15 more minutes. I want to ask you a couple of questions about your other books. But before I do that, I do have a question here on Odyssey. Eugene Greenbeard writes in with $5. Thank you very much. Do you have any opinion on Ibsen? He started out in the Norwegian national romantic tradition in the 1850s, but became disillusioned and ended up with an almost proto-postmodern deconstructing tendency in Peer Gynt. He's difficult to get a bead on, but he seems to me like an aristocratic reactionary. What are your thoughts on Ibsen?
Well, first to say, I'm not an Ibsen expert. He was seen as a modernist, but he was also seen as something. He became essentially part of the establishment by the 1880s and by the 1890s. He was seen as sort of like as the grand old man. And he had been kind of absorbed and maybe perhaps defanged or neutered by the Norwegian literary establishment, which, as you can imagine, was quite small because Norway is quite a small nation. And it's very interesting that when Knut Hamsun arose, And he gave a series of lectures in, I think, 1891 or so, about the time when he published Hunger, which is an astonishing novel, which everyone has to read. Knut Hamsun gave these lectures, and they were quite fiercely critical of Ibsen. And Ibsen was actually in the audience when he gave this speech. So Ibsen was seen as an impediment to modernism, to new artists, to vitalist artists. Now, Hamsun later moved on to become something of a perennialist himself. So you think maybe this is just like an eternal cycle where you start as a rebel and you end up as part of the establishment. Knut Hamsun, interesting subject, probably too in-depth to discuss here. But yeah, obviously he got into trouble after the Second World War because he supported the Nazi Party directly and indirectly. But Ibsen... Yeah, Ibsen, I would like to write more about this. He by the time of the end of his career, he was seen as a stalwart of a Norwegian national literary establishment, even though he had been extremely controversial when he started up as a boundary breaking modernist.
So can you give me your opinions? You're a painter as well as a critic. What are your thoughts on the paintings of Wyndham Lewis?
Oh, well, very good. I like them very much. It's unfortunate he didn't do as much painting as he should. He spent too much time writing, even though I do enjoy his writing as well. He had a tendency to sign lots of contracts for books because he would spend the advance because the royalties and were not very high, so he would take the advance and then he'd be quite reluctant to write the book. But he ended up writing so many books just simply because he was getting these advances. It would have been great if he'd had a couple of really big novels and he could have coasted on that and returned to painting. Yeah, so Wyndham Lewis, one of the 1914 men, founder of Vorticism, which was claimed to be the only original art movement founded in Britain. Wyndham Lewis actually born in Canada, so he's a British subject who's of the Dominion of Canada as it then was, even though he's seen as essentially British, which I think is correct. He spent most of his life in London. I'm a big fan of Wyndham Lewis, radical modernist, reactionary, and his paintings quite closely influenced by futurism, but very distinctive. And I would recommend that people check out the Vorticist movement and Wyndham Lewis in particular, especially in the 1910s and 1920s, went on to produce some great portraits as well, including a couple of striking ones of T.S. Eliot, who was a close friend of his.
I love his Eliot and Pound portraits. I think he was a tremendously talented artist. And so I'm glad you like it. You mentioned Jonathan Bowden's writings on art, but he was also a painter. He did illustrations, comics, things like that. What are your views of Bowden's visual art?
From what I've seen of it, the little that I've seen of it, I find him quite intriguing because he's a mixture of being an extremely astute and intelligent observer of art. And you just have to read the book that I've been mentioning again and again, more than my own book, Reactionary Modernism, published by Countercurrents. If you just read that, you can see how knowledgeable he is about art. And yet, when you look at his art, you look at his style and the materials he's using, he's almost like an outsider artist. And this is quite interesting. Is he choosing to be an outsider artist because he was not trained? He didn't go to art school. Is this something that naturally occurred? Or did he see some sort of vitalism or exciting rawness in the outsider artists? Was this a deliberate conscious strategy on his part, or was it just his style? I don't know. I'd be interested to actually look at it and perhaps even write a couple of essays on him.
That would be very interesting. I am trying to get a project off the ground where first we can digitize all of his paintings and add them to the Jonathan Bowden archive in really high quality images, because occasionally, about once a year, somebody writes to me and says, could we get prints of some of Bowden's paintings? And I would love to be able to make that possible. Jonathan's literary and, I guess, artistic, his heir, I guess, not just executor, but heir, has the biggest Jonathan Bowden art collection, about 300 pieces. I have the second biggest of three. I just have three. There are not many people who are buying his things. And unfortunately, he ran out of time before I could buy more pieces from him. But I rather liked some of his art. I really rather liked. So it's interesting. And I'd love to have your take on it in writing someday. Let's end by talking about a couple more of your books. We've talked about Blood, Soil, and Paint, some of the themes in that, Romanticism, Modernism, Munch. There's a very interesting chapter in there on the Isle of the Dead that I thought was quite eye-opening, just as a little bit of history of art. You've plugged your forthcoming book on Dali, but you mentioned two other books, a book on Magritte and a book on Degas. Can you tell us a bit about each of those volumes? Those are in print currently and available.
Yes. So those are both from Prestel and they're available internationally. So Degas was interesting. Yeah, he was a genuine reactionary. If you look at his politics, he was an anti-Dreyfusard. The Dreyfus affair was, of course, a dividing line between traditionalists and liberals in French 19th century society in sort of, 1890s, I think it was. And Degas was a genuine opponent of Dreyfus, and he made quite a few anti-Semitic comments, although he was actually on friendly terms with quite a few Jewish people. So it's kind of interesting that there is this divide in his work, in his outlook. This is sort of not touched on very much because I think a lot of liberals are kind of embarrassed that this painter of beautiful ballerina pictures and one of the greatest painters of all time happens to be very strongly reactionary. Magritte, very interesting character, quite subversive, Belgian. He was actually a member of the Communist Party for a few years, and he was, and that was essentially a lot of people, including Picasso, they joined the Communist Party after the Second World War, when it was relatively safe to do so, because they were just sort of grateful for their anti-fascist, anti-National Socialist efforts. So they just wanted to show that they were good humanitarians and liberals, and, you know, they were sort of they wanted their anti-fascist credentials buffed, so they joined the Communist Party. But Magritte was a genuinely subversive character, and he didn't stick it for very long. And I would recommend looking. I mean, once you look at Magritte's art, you can see that he was extremely unconventional, but also very reflective and quite poetical. I think he thought of himself not as a painter, but as a visual poet, which I think is quite apt.
I saw a huge Magritte exhibition in San Francisco in the summer of 2018, and I was quite bowled over by it. Yeah, I was. I'd seen his things reproduced on, or morphed on album covers and, notebooks and things like that, refrigerator magnets over the years.
The fate of all great artists to end up on a fridge magnet.
Yeah. And I wasn't prepared. It was just a whim. A friend of mine wanted to go see it. We were in San Francisco. Okay, let's go see Magritte. And we were both taken by his work and quite surprised by how he's obviously a rather deep figure. Mm. And I was also very impressed by how his canvases some of them will really fill a room. They're really quite compelling. Your mind does not wander. And a lot of them are sort of voyeuristic. It's like it's not like you're looking at something hanging in a gallery. It's like you're looking through them, like you're peeping through windows at aspects of life that might otherwise be hidden. I found that very strange. But anyway, I was definitely going to look at your takes on Magritte and Degas, as well as your book on Dali. And I've enjoyed Blood, Soil, and Paint quite a lot. So why don't we wrap up by you reminding people how they can follow your work? Where are you on the World Wide Web?
So geographically, I'm in Northern England, but for everyone else, if you want to find my writings and my thoughts, you can follow me on @AdamsArtist on Twitter. I don't engage very much. I'm not very active. I'm not a reply guy or anything like that. So it's mainly pretty dry stuff. It's sort of announcements and also images of my art. If you do want to follow my art and have a look at that, you can go to alexanderadams.art. And there is a link on that website also if you want to buy some art catalogues. Now, the books that we've mentioned, the books by Prestel, the Blood, Soil, Paint, and also books like Culture War, Artivism, Women and Art, and so forth, they're all available through normal bookselling websites. But the art catalogues of my work, you can only get through Bornbrook, which is linked through my art website, which is alexanderadams.art. And if you want to read my thoughts on culture, politics, literature, and so forth, you can go to alexanderadamsart.substack.com, which is my writings. You can become an unpaid subscriber and get essays there. Paid subscribers really do help me out, and support is much appreciated, and you will get exclusive content there.
Wonderful. Well, it's been a real pleasure to finally make your acquaintance. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And I always say this, but I always mean it when I say it. I hope this is just the first conversation of many. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Brooke.